Steam shovels sank in the jungle ooze. And red rust rotted the iron tools, and monkeys moved in where the French had lived. And the trade winds wept on their graves. Scarlet birds and butterflies and concrete crumbling. And the cries of parrots filled the ditch the French had started. But while the jungle mocked the efforts of men, the dream lived on. This is Inheritance, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with the American Legion. Stories out of that great fabric of visions, struggles, and accomplishments of the American past. Stories of our inheritance. We turn now in time to a memorable moment in our history. A moment which shall be the beginning of today's story from our inheritance. Men had dreamed of it for centuries, a passageway from the Gulf of Panama to the Caribbean Sea. Especially in the United States, the dream lived. Everybody agreed that such a canal was necessary to our defense, as well as a good thing for trade. In 1904, under President Theodore Roosevelt, arrangements were completed, and as those who worked on the canal put it, the dirt began to fly. Something else began to fly, too. Mosquitoes. They came in swarms, and they came in droves, and they came in multitudes. And in their bite, they carried the poisonous and formidable and usually fatal disease, yellow fever. It's a matter of record that if yellow fever hadn't been beaten in Panama, the canal couldn't have been built. But built it was, and the story of that fight is known. But not enough has been said about one of the men who played a most important part in that battle, William Crawford Gorgas, a physician in uniform and sanitary officer of the United States Army. On August 15th, 1914, at 8 a.m., the United States vessel Ancon glided out of the Atlantic Ocean and into the mouth of the Panama Canal, the first vessel to complete the 51-mile voyage across the isthmus. At 3:20 in the afternoon, the Ancon arrived safely at the Pacific Ocean. In the cheering crowds that lined the locks stood Colonel Willie Gorgas, his wife Marie, and Colonel George W. Gethels, chairman of the Canal Commission.
Well, Willie, how do you feel?
Solemn. And you, George?
Grateful.
Yes, I feel that too. It was a great honor to take part in something so vast, so vital, so important to our country.
Especially after everybody predicted it couldn't be done.
And it couldn't have been done if it hadn't been for Willie Gorgas. If we hadn't had you, Willie, we'd all be dead.
No, somebody else
would. No, it took your personality, your special knowledge of yellow fever. How did it ever happen, Willie? What stroke of luck brought you to the canal zone?
Maybe it was luck. Maybe it was fate. It's hard to know. On this day of triumph, my mind went back over the events that had brought me to Panama. And it seemed to me that everything that had ever happened to me had prepared me for this assignment. It had begun even so far back as 1854, at Tumanville, Alabama, the day I was born, and my mother said,
"Well, Josiah, what do you think of your West Pointer?"
"Well, I think he'll never make it in the army. He sleeps too soundly to ever be awakened by a bugler."
"Oh, Josiah, how can such a tiny little thing ever grow up to be a lieutenant?"
"Well, not a lieutenant, Amelia. A general."
"And what are we going to name General Gorgas?"
"Not Josiah. It's always been a burden to me. Takes away a certain camaraderie that should exist between soldiers to be called Josiah. Let's call him something that can grow into a nickname or something easily said.
I've always favored the name William.
William Gorgas? Mm-hmm. Needs something else.
Crawford's a good old family name. It's been a long time in Alabama.
Yes, I like that too.
Wake up, William Crawford Gorgas. Are you going to sleep away the whole first day of your life?
I remember as a child that one of my family's best friends was Dr. Knott, the doctor who had delivered me. And especially I remember a day in his laboratory when I questioned him about the contents of a small wire cage.
Mosquitoes, Willie. Surely you know a mosquito when you see one.
But why do you keep them in a cage, sir?
Because they might get out and bite you.
You got any snakes or frogs?
No, just mosquitoes.
What do you want with them?
Well, somewhere in those mosquitoes is a connection with a thing called yellow fever. I'm trying to find that connection.
What's yellow fever?
Yellow fever is an acute, specific, infectious disease caused by a filterable virus and marked by fever, jaundice, and albuminuria.
Yeah, that's hard. Well, what does it mean?
Well, it's meant the death of a lot of people.
Well, why didn't you give them some medicine?
Well, we don't know what medicine to use.
But what have the mosquitoes got to do with it?
Nobody knows, Willie. But Mr. Noah Webster, you know, the man who wrote the dictionary?
Oh, yes, sir.
Well, he pointed out that every time there's been a severe epidemic of yellow fever, it has been in places at times when mosquitoes were most frequent and most active. Well, someday somebody will find out. Maybe you'd like to try, Willie.
Oh, no, sir, I won't have time. I'm going to West Point and be a soldier like my father. During the war, my father was chief of ordnance for the Confederacy. And after the bitterness of that struggle, he put away uniforms forever. He became president of the University of the South at Suwanee, Tennessee. But I still felt my own passionate desire to be a soldier. The year I was 21, I applied for entrance to West Point. Waiting was tedious. I remember the morning my mother was playing the piano, and I sat nearby.
Willie, have I put you sound asleep?
Not at all, Mother. I was thinking.
Let me see now. What would Willie Gorgas be thinking right this minute? Past, present, or future?
Future.
Now I know. Willie Gorgas, pride of West Point, first in his studies, most esteemed by his classmates, and the admiration of every fluttering girlish heart.
Mother, is it foolish to wish for such things?
Oh, it isn't foolish, Willie. Only I could never understand what makes men want to become soldiers.
Well, it's the only thing I've ever wanted to be.
Your father's very proud of you, Willie. I think he sees in you himself as a young man starting out at West Point.
But it's getting awfully close to the beginning of this term. I wish they'd hurry up and let me know if I'm accepted.
Oh, Willie, there's no question of being accepted. President Grant himself has written to the Secretary of War for you.
Oh, yes, Mother, I suppose I've just gotten nervous waiting for some word.
Well, of all things.
What is it, Mother?
I just caught sight of your father coming up the front walk. He was running.
Willie! Willie, here it is.
Let's see, Father.
Well, open it, Willie, open it.
You open it, Mother. You always bring me luck.
All right, Willie.
Hurry, Mother.
Be patient, Willie, a little patience.
Well, Mother?
Son, it's not what we expected.
What?
Then it's not my telegram?
It's for you, Willie. But the news is not good.
Huh? What does it say, Amelia?
Dear sir, I deeply regret to inform you that your application to the United States Military Academy at West Point, after due consideration by the Secretary of War, was not granted.
I'm sorry, son.
Oh, Willie,
I don't understand.
Now, Willie, there are other careers than that of being a soldier.
Father, there's nothing else for me.
Oh, Willie, try not to take on, dear. It'll hurt a little less tomorrow.
Mother, I think for once in your life you may be wrong. I think it'll hurt even worse tomorrow. As a matter of fact, my rejection by West Point did hurt little more the following day. But then the pain grew less, but not my determination to get into the Army. For a while, I was bitterly frustrated. And I think the first ray of hope came when I made my disappointment known to my old friend, Dr. Knott.
Of course, Will, there are other ways of getting into the Army than through West Point.
Oh, I could volunteer as a private soldier, but I had it planned differently.
I was thinking that medical officers go in as lieutenants. The Army needs doctors.
Well, that's a profession I'd never thought about.
It's my profession, Will, and I would trust you with it. Your mind is above the average, and your heart is in the place a doctor's heart should be. You're kind, gentle, have a love of people that had become you as a doctor.
Well, I'll think about it, Doctor, and thank you. I must confess it was not so much a doctor I wanted to be in the beginning as I wanted to be an officer in the Army. That was why I was especially disappointed when I took Dr. Knott to my father with this plan.
Willie, I'd hoped that you might find some other job you'd be happy with.
I guess I am being pig-headed, Father, but I've counted on the Army for so long, I just can't get it out of my head. I've just got to get in somehow.
Willie would make a good doctor, whether he does it in the Army or as a civilian. And I've got a notion, Josiah, and I'll say it in front of you, Willie. Once you start doctoring, the Army isn't going to matter so much to you.
Oh, you don't know me, Doc.
Son, I wouldn't mind your taking up medicine, but I'll lay it right on the line. I haven't got the money to send you to school.
Well, I'll work. I'll pay my own way.
I wouldn't make this suggestion, but I brought you into the world, Willie, and I take a personal interest in you. I've got a little money.
Oh, no, Doctor, no, I couldn't
thank
you. Oh, I know you're proud and all, and I'm not offering to pay your way, Willie. Just part of it. And I'll expect it back, every cent.
And so it was that in September of 1876, I enrolled as a medical student at Bellevue Medical College in New York City. In order to cut down on expenses, I moved into a boarding house on East 30th Street with a fellow student who was from Paris, Kentucky, John Bowen. Life with Bowen did not consist entirely of memorizing symptoms and the names of muscles. Once in a while, I'd arrive home to have him announce,
"Willie, son, I have got the dooms."
"Well, what kind of dooms you got, son?"
"I got them kind of dooms that just kind of sneak up on you. Now, son, you know the kind of dooms I mean."
"I reckon you mean them homesick dooms, don't you, son?"
"I reckon."
"Well, how you aiming to take care of them, son?"
"I got myself an idea, and that is to go home to Kentucky. But there's an amount of cash involved that just gives me the dooms even worse."
"Son, it hurts my soul to see you taking on that way. You want to get out somewhere and just holler for a while?"
"Well, son, if you feel like hollering, we can do that right here."
"Well, son, considering the fact that we're here in the heart of Yankee territory, it might be powerful smart if we did holler right here."
"Whatever you say, son."
"All right, son, just stand at attention and squall."
"You ready, son?"
"I sure am."
"Oh, I wish I were in the land of cotton. Old folks there are not forgotten. Look
come
away.
Come on, son, you can holler
look
louder
away,
than that. Come on.
Look away, look away. Oh, I wish I were in Dixie. Hooray, hooray. In Dixieland I'll take my stand and live and die in Dixie. Hooray,
hooray, hooray.
I'll live and die in Dixie."
The year I became a senior, my father resigned as president of the University of the South to become president of the University of Alabama. He hadn't any more arrived in Tuscaloosa when an epidemic broke out. He and mother left right away, and they came to see me in New York.
"Well, we stayed to the last, Willie. We did everything we could."
"And what could you do?"
"The only thing left to do was to read the funeral service over those who had died."
"But how could you leave as long as anyone was left there still living?"
"We left like everybody else that could walk. I had the price of a train ticket. Even then, there was something close to a riot getting on the train. So little room and everybody wanting to leave."
"Then how was transportation into Tuscaloosa?"
"The trains are still running, but they carry mostly coffins."
"Well, we'll tend to that. Mother, Father, please excuse me. I'll see you later."
"Willie, where are you going?"
"To Tuscaloosa, Mother." "Well, what about it, John? Rhodes and Wilson are willing, and I think we can talk Benson into going. How about you?
Well, son, they'll kick us out of school just taking off like that and not asking permission.
But I intend asking permission. I'll put it to them this way, John. They need doctors there, and we're almost doctors. What better way to study the disease than jump smack into the middle of an epidemic?
Or looking at it another way, what better way to get yourself a little bit dead?
Son, what kind of a rebel are you? Johnny, yellow fever's a southern disease. All the big epidemics have hit the South, Memphis, New Orleans. It's our disease and...
Son, I am with you all the way. It's just that I hated to break my date with that little nurse of mine Saturday night.
Well, then don't break it. Bring her along. We'll need some nurses, too. In all, we numbered about 20 doctors and nurses when we headed for the epidemic. Spirits were high and stayed that way until we reached the outskirts of the city and a military guard came on board the train.
Hey, where are all you folks think you're going? Don't you know there's a yellow fever epidemic here?
Yes, sir, that's why we're here. We're interns and nurses from Bellevue Medical College.
Oh, we can use every one of you. You're all immune, I take it. Oh,
yeah, well, sure.
And I'll see your cards and you can go to work.
Cards?
Immunity cards.
Well, the truth is we left so quickly we didn't have a chance to get them, but they'll be down later by mail.
Doc, you're trying to lie to me, aren't you?
Since you put it that way, yes.
I'm sorry to do this, but I can't let you folks pass. You can't go into Tuscaloosa without an immunity card. We've got enough people to bury already.
Try as we might, we were not allowed in the city. And at night, standing there, watching carloads of coffins pouring in, and those in terror who fled the city, I began to hate yellow fever with a personal and consuming passion. We returned to our studies in New York, and in 1879, the night before we graduated, Bowen and I went out to holler together for the last time.
Willie, son, I could walk from here to Louisville. Just thinking of going home puts glory in my heart again.
You going to hang out your shingle right away, John?
No, I'm going to tear up the pea patch a little while. Then I'm going to learn to talk Kentucky talk all over again. And I can find myself a little Kentucky gal and settle down and live the rest of my life in, guess where?
Ohio, probably. Look, John, why don't you come and join the Army with me?
Son, I've been meaning to talk to you about that. Hey, you can do better things than treating blisters and sniffles. Why don't you come down to Kentucky? We'll set up an office together.
Johnny, I went to med school in the first place so that I could get into the Army. That's all I've wanted ever since I was knee-high to a tadpole.
Well, son, I wish you luck. And I know whatever they give you to do, you'll do it 10 times better than anybody else could.
In June of 1880, I was accepted in the medical department of the United States Army at a salary of $133 a month. I lost no time in showing off my new uniform to my mother and father, who had returned to Tuscaloosa after the epidemic was over.
Willie, you're just as handsome in your uniform as your father was. Isn't he, Josiah?
Willie makes a very passable-looking soldier. What I wonder, son, is how satisfying it is to be a soldier and a doctor at the same time.
Right at the moment, very satisfying, Father. I'm being assigned to Fort Brown in Texas. There are several cases on the post, and I've been very anxious to have a look at it close up.
Cases of what, son? Yellow fever?
Yes, sir.
I thought so.
Oh, Willie, how much better I'd feel if you were an ordinary doctor delivering babies and treating mumps and chicken pox. Why would anyone want to go near yellow fever?
Well, I've done considerable reading on it, Mother, and I'm strangely interested by it.
Son, the French are having quite an epidemic of it down in Panama.
Panama? Oh, yes, that's where the French are trying to dig a canal, isn't it?
Must you men talk of tragedies and yellow fever and epidemics? Let's draw the draperies and pretend there's no such place as Panama in Brownsville, Texas. Let's be happy. Come, Willie, Josiah, I'll play the piano for you.
My desire to have a close-up look at yellow fever was more than gratified at Fort Brown. The post was in the grips of a severe epidemic, and as soon as someone contracted the disease, death seemed so imminent that relatives began preparing the grave. One night I was awakened by the commander of the post, Colonel William Lister.
Doctor,
Yes, sir.
Doctor, my sister-in-law is complaining of a chill. She insists it's only a cold, but then again...
Yes, it could be the fever.
I've transportation outside.
I'll be there at once, sir.
Marie, this is Dr. Gorgas.
How do you do, Doctor?
How do you feel, Miss Doty?
I have a violent headache. A little while ago, I had a chill, but now it's turned to fever.
Are you thirsty?
Very.
Do you feel any pain?
Yes, in my limbs.
Colonel Lester, will you see me to the door, please?
Yes, certainly.
Good night, Miss Doty. I'll look in on you in the morning. We'll know better then. Good night.
Good night, Doctor.
Sir, it's definitely yellow fever.
I knew. I've just lost my wife and my son. I recognized it when I saw her. Doctor, I know you're hard-pressed, but I've taken all I can stand. When she dies, would you be good enough to read the burial service? I don't think I...
Of course, sir. But it will give me considerable pain, too. I think she's the most beautiful woman I have ever laid eyes on. The following morning, when I called on Marie Doty, I found her much worse. The jaundice, which gave the disease its name, was very pronounced, and she was in severe pain. Miss Doty.
Yes.
Do you know who this is?
Doctor.
Yes. Now try to hear what I'm saying.
Yes.
You must live. Can you hear me?
What?
I want you to live.
Talk.
Take my hand. Now listen. I will stay with you. I want you to live. I want you to live. Miraculously, Marie Doty did live. And when she was well enough to sit up, I found myself more and more impatient for that time of day when I was to make my customary call.
Good afternoon, Doctor.
You're looking much better today.
I'm feeling much better today. I'll miss your daily visits soon when I'm well.
I, too, shall miss them.
I cannot remember well, but one night in my delirium, did you not stay the night? I remember waking several times and thinking I saw your face there.
Yes.
And you talked to me.
Yes, I did, Marie.
I don't even know your first name.
Everyone calls me Willie.
Oh, Willie. You've never known me when I'm well. Wait till I'm free to go out of doors and ride and walk and... Willie, look at me.
Yes, Marie.
How do you feel?
Oh, well enough. I'm tired. I've been working very hard.
Look in this mirror. Here.
Maybe I've been working too hard. I look like sin.
Look at your eyes. They're turning yellow, just like mine were. Willie, you have yellow fever.
I did indeed have yellow fever. And I watched it both as a doctor and as a patient, observing the disease take hold of my body. The pronounced jaundiced color of my eyes and skin, the rapid pulse of the congestive stage changed to the slow pulse of the toxemic stage. And through the whole course of the disease, the fiery, racking seizures of fever. And then the fever subsided, and I was on my way to recovery. Also, I was deeply in love.
Your nurse says I may stay only a few minutes.
Oh, it's been the most exhilarating experience of my life, Marie. The opportunity to see the disease, to feel it, observe it, both as a doctor and a patient. Now tell me, how soon does this dizziness disappear?
I'm still quite dizzy.
And your pulse. Give me a hand, let me see.
I'm afraid it's faster than usual.
Tell me, did the pain remain long after the 10th day?
Only a little weakness.
Well, describe it.
Well, at first it was like walking on air.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes it was like intoxication. And at other times I was seized by the most severe depressions.
Depressions?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's an interesting yellow fever symptom. Tell me more about them.
Well, I noticed they usually cleared up around 3 every afternoon.
Depressions automatically vanishing at 3 in the afternoon? Why, you should have mentioned it while... I was there. Didn't I always make my call at 3?
Yes, Willie.
I truly hadn't hoped that you... It was more than I could wish for, Marie. That night when you were so sick, I said...
I know what you said.
Even then I knew. That very first night.
I know. I was not so delirious as I seemed.
Oh, I do love you, Marie.
How, Willie?
In every way. But why do you ask how?
Because I had begun to think you found me interesting only as a yellow fever patient in the recuperative state.
Marie, will you do me the honor of becoming my wife?
Yes, Willie. Yes.
Thus went the thoughts of William Crawford Gargas on the day he stood and watched the first vessel complete the passage which marked the official opening of the Panama Canal.
Well, we'd never have seen this day, Willie, if you hadn't come down here and killed off Yellow Jack. It's your victory.
Sir, I think it's a victory for the American people.
At any rate, Willie, we dug the big ditch.
They built her all right, and she's as busy today as she ever was. A boon to commerce in time of peace, a mighty weapon in time of war. A monument not only to the engineers and laborers and architects who built her, but to an army doctor who made it possible, William Crawford Gargas. You've been listening to Inheritance, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with the American Legion. And now it's our privilege to hear from a National Vice Commander of the Legion, Mr. Leonard L. Jackson. Mr. Jackson.
Watch the sky. A civilian member of the Ground Observer Corps is as essential in protecting the security of the nation as a soldier in arms. Ground Observer Corps, now operating on a 24-hour-a-day basis, needs at least 200,000 trained civilian plane spotters to help fill the gap in our radar system. Since the introduction of advanced air power techniques around 1939, the American Legion has been aware that a system of civilian defense is a necessary safeguard for peace. Early in World War II, the Legion sent a delegation to England, the first country to organize such a system, to study their home defense methods. The finding of these missions became the groundwork for the first civil defense program in the United States. The Legion set up a defense division to produce and distribute civil defense manuals and to organize and finance state air raid warden schools. At the same time, on the local level, thousands of American Legion posts set up aircraft observer stations manned by Legionnaires day and night. Following the war, the Legion and National Convention urged continuing civilian preparedness in view of current unsettled world conditions, and in 1951 pledged its wholehearted support to the Federal Civil Defense Program, reaffirming this pledge in succeeding conventions. Currently, lending its strong support to rescue squad work, blood donor recruitment, as well as Ground Observer Corps programs, the Legion urges its own membership and invites all other security-minded citizens to assist Ground Observer Corps in safeguarding the peace and the freedom of our inheritance.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. The many of you who have expressed your interest in last week's story about Mother Bickerdyke will find the career of the heroic Civil War nurse treated more fully in the biography by Nina Brown Baker, entitled Cyclone in Calico. Next week, Inheritance will again take you on a journey through the pages of American history. Today's story about William Crawford Gargas was written by Earl Hamner. The music was composed and conducted by Roy Shield. William Crawford Gargas was played by Bob Hastings. Others in the cast were Everett Sloan, Kenneth Delmar, Peggy Allenby, Donald Buca, and Jane Webb. Inheritance was produced by Wade Arnold and directed by Harry Frazee. This is Bill Hanrahan speaking.
Enjoy fine variety entertainment on the Dennis Day Show today over most NBC radio stations.